Hello, this is Best Practice. I'm Richard Adey. You've come up with a plan, you've thought about it, you've reviewed it, you've tweaked it, it's perfect. The future of your organisation rests on getting it right, so there's a lot at stake. But there's one thing you probably haven't done, and according to Bryce Hoffman, it's a crucial step. That's to have someone else really pick it apart, play the devil's advocate, or as Bryce calls it, red teaming. He says it could save you from disaster, or at the other end of the scale, make your great plan even better. Bryce Hoffman's the author of Red Teaming, How to Transform Your Business by Thinking Like the Enemy.
So the idea behind red teaming is really based on research that's been done over the past 40 years into cognitive psychology and the human decision-making process. And what that research has really conclusively proved, Richard, is that no matter how smart we are, no matter how well-educated we are, no matter how experienced in our careers we are, we all make decisions that are skewed in unpredictable ways by biases, by blind spots, and by just these shortcuts that our brains take when we try to tackle complex problems. So recognizing that that's the case, red teaming is designed to help individuals and organizations make better decisions and make better strategies by overcoming those blind spots and biases through the tools and techniques that I describe in the book.
I suppose the most basic form of it, it goes back to the Catholic Church's idea of having a devil's advocate.
Absolutely. So, you know, if you go back to the beginning of the Renaissance, the Catholic Church had a problem. They had too many saints, and they were making new ones every month. And so the Pope at the time, who's got to be one of the best-named popes in history, Pope Sixtus V, not to be confused with Pope Fifth the Sixth, Pope Sixtus V came up with a brilliant idea. He said, you know, we have this new age of reason that we've entered into here, so let's apply some of this modern reasonable thinking to the question of saints. And so he created an office of the devil's advocate, which people don't realize, but it was actually an actual office in the Catholic Church. And he appointed a priest who was a canon lawyer to be the devil's advocate. And the job of that priest was to look at every candidate for sainthood and try to argue as strongly as possible that they were not, in fact, saints, that their miracles, in fact, had logical scientific explanations, that their good deeds were, in fact, nothing more than blatant self-promotion. And when they started doing this, the number of new saints being created each year by the church dropped dramatically. And this process actually continued until modern times. In fact, when Mother Teresa was put forward for sainthood, the Catholic Church actually called the famous atheist Christopher Hitchens to testify against her for the devil's advocate. So that's one of the core ideas that red teaming draws on, is this idea that even if you have a plan or a strategy that looks perfect, that looks like the best plan or strategy possible, by having someone on your team or having a team of people like a red team whose job it is to try to argue that it's not the best plan, that it's got holes in it, that there are weak spots, what that will do is one of two things. Richard, it will either expose those weak spots so that you can fix them and avoid disaster, or it will help you strengthen the plan that is a good plan after all by subjecting it to that sort of rigorous testing. That is one of the core key concepts behind red teaming.
Just on Hitchens, and I think you mentioned this in the book, I recall this at the time though, he wasn't paid for that.
That's right.
So he afterwards was a bit, well, he kind of ruefully said that he'd done work for the devil pro bono. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so we get now to, I suppose, the next major step in the development of this, although this must have always happened in an ad hoc way, but it was the Israelis after the Yom Kippur War, wasn't it, that was sort of the next big developmental step?
Absolutely. So, you know, Richard, the lead up to the Yom Kippur War is one of the most amazing examples of intelligence failure and a failure of imagination in history. So the Israelis had tons of intelligence that told them that Syria and Egypt were about to invade them. And when I say tons of intelligence, I don't mean just that their reconnaissance planes were flying over those two countries and could see the tank columns moving towards the Israeli border, which they could. I don't mean that they had intercepted Soviet communications saying, hey, guys, let's get out of Cairo and Damascus because Syria and Egypt are about to invade Israel, which they did. I mean, literally, the prime minister of Jordan, the king of Jordan, King Hussein of Jordan, got in his helicopter and flew to Golda Meir's house and said, Madam Prime Minister, you're about to be invaded. Why haven't you mobilized your armies? And the reason the Israelis hadn't mobilized their armies is because they believed they had cracked the Arab code, not the cipher, but the Arab mindset. And they had come up with this idea that they knew that this was just posturing, that this was just designed to force them to the negotiating table, that this wasn't a real invasion. And this had happened a couple times before, and they'd been right. So since they'd been right, they had come to believe that they had really, like I said, cracked the code. Except this time it wasn't right. This time it was a real invasion, and this was the only time that Israel was actually almost defeated. And so in the aftermath of that near defeat, the Israelis had a moment where they said, how do we make sure nothing like this ever happens again? And the answer that they came up with to that question, Richard, was let's create an office inside our military intelligence department that will function like a modern day devil's advocate, that will take whatever the prevailing thinking of our Security Council is and argue that the opposite is true. And that's what they did. And they haven't had a near defeat like that ever since. So going, you know, looking at these examples, the U.S. military and the U.S. intelligence community had a similar epiphany after 9/11 when they suffered their own failures of imagination.
You point to the central role of a guy called Steve Rotkopf in developing this.
That's right. Colonel Steve Rotkopf, who's now a business partner of mine, was the number two intelligence officer for the ground invasion of Iraq. And in the lead up to the invasion, he saw a lot of things that really gave him pause and made him think maybe this was not such a good idea after all. Maybe, you know, toppling Saddam Hussein was not going to lead to, you know, the wonderful outcomes that America's military planners imagined that it would, with, you know, beautiful Iraqi women, you know, throwing flowers at the feet of the liberating soldiers from the U.S. and U.K. and Australia and other places. Maybe it was going to turn out a little bit differently. And when it did turn out more than a little bit differently, he was actually brought back to the Pentagon to lead one of the lessons learned teams that the military set up to figure out how did this all fall apart? How did the victories that were won in Iraq and Afghanistan unravel so rapidly? And what could be done to make sure that didn't happen again? And what Colonel Rotkopf felt and persuaded the Pentagon to accept was that the real problem was that we had not challenged our own assumptions, that we had taken a lot of things for granted that we shouldn't have, you know, like the fact that taking out Iraq's electrical grid in the middle of summer in the desert would not turn people against us because they'd be so thrilled that we'd overthrow their hated dictator that they'd forgive us for that. Things like that. And so what he proposed was that the military set up what he called red teams, teams at every part of the military that would have the job of kind of forcing the organization to challenge its own assumptions and to ask the tough questions that weren't asked in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq and the lead up to the invasion of Afghanistan. And that was approved, and he and others helped create a school for red teaming at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where senior military officers were trained in these techniques. And then this was kind of disseminated through the U.S. military. And it almost overnight started changing the way the military functioned when it was allowed to work. And Richard, that's an important caveat because, you know, in the United States, our military is not, as in most countries, you know, is not able to make decisions on its own. It has to refer to the politicians. So an example of when red teaming worked really well was in 2007 when we had this troop surge in Iraq, which was designed to kind of secure the country so that we could pull our troops out. And it was amazingly effective, even though it was very counterintuitive, which was the idea of, you know, the way that you pull out of the country is by sending more troops into the country. Unfortunately, it was so successful that even though the generals who had taken this kind of red teaming point of view and come up with this plan had said, you know, this needs like a year or two to work, the politicians were like, no, it's working. Let's declare victory and pull everybody out right now so we can win the next election round. And then everything fell apart and we ran into the problem we have now. But when it's been allowed to work, Richard, it's been so effective that it was rapidly adopted by other branches of the U.S. military, like the U.S. Marines, but then also by allied militaries, like the British military and the Australian military and the New Zealand Defense Forces, have all created their own red teams and begin applying these same tools and techniques to their military plans and strategies.
All right, Bryce, let's talk about now applying it to business, because that's mainly what we're going to focus on. If you are the head of a big corporation, and you know heads of big corporations, and you're interested in this, in red teaming, how do you start? What are the first things you need to do?
Well, if you're the head of a big corporation and you're interested in red teaming, then kudos to you, first off, because that means you're the type of leader that knows that there are things that you don't know, and you want to find them out, because that's what red teaming will provide for you. And the way to incorporate red teaming into your company, there's many different ways. And I talk about the different models for red teaming in the book. You know, at the simplest end of the spectrum, you can take the tools and techniques that I talk about in the book and that I walk people through how to use. And you can use those with your own leadership team to kind of test your own strategies and plans. And that's not a bad thing, but it's really not red teaming properly. Because proper red teaming requires another set of eyes on the problem than the group that created the plan in the first place. Because it's hard to grade your own homework objectively, right? So the best way to incorporate red teaming is to involve either bringing in an outside red team facilitator to lead your organization through red teaming analysis. So somebody who's trained in red teaming tools and techniques can lead a company through a red teaming analysis. That's something we do a lot with our clients. And the other thing that you can do, if you have the resources, both in terms of personnel and time and that sort of thing, is create an actual red team within your organization, either an ad hoc red team or a standing red team, where people in your organization are trained in these tools and techniques and can use them not to replace your existing planning function, but in conjunction with your existing planning function to make your strategies and plans better and to make better decisions. And again, that's something that I've been working on a lot with companies around the world since the book came out and even before, is teaching people how to be red teamers.
Yeah, Bryce, in the book and in your professional practice, there's lots of different practical examples, and you describe it as a bit like a golf bag, different clubs for different purposes and situations. Just walk us through one or two simple ones so people get the idea of kind of how to do this.
Sure. At the simplest level, Richard, red teaming, as I said, is really about accepting the fact that every strategy, every plan, every decision that you make is based on assumptions. And there's nothing wrong with that, because you have to make assumptions in life. An assumption, hopefully, is really just a fact that's not yet true, but will become true in the future. So, you know, if you have a plan to, let's say you've got a going concern in Australia and you say, you know what, this would be really great if we expanded this to the New Zealand market. There's assumptions in there, like that what's working in Australia will work in New Zealand. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But that's an assumption. But you have to make assumptions like that as part of business. So one of the easiest things that you can do to kind of see how red teaming starts to work is to simply look at your strategy, look at your plan, and try to make a list of all of the assumptions that it's based on. Not just the stated assumptions, but the unstated assumptions, the unspoken assumptions, the underlying assumptions. And then once you've got that list, start asking yourself some tough questions about those assumptions. Say, how do I know this is likely to be true? Am I basing this on something objective, or am I basing this on a gut feeling or past experience? And if I'm basing it on past experience, is that really a relevant analogy, or is the current situation maybe a little bit different? So sticking with our example, for instance, if you say, you know, we're assuming that our business that's doing so well in Australia will do just as well in New Zealand. Is that based on having done market research in New Zealand? Or is that based on just a feeling that you have, you know, that, hey, you know, it's great here, it must be great everywhere else? Maybe there are things about the New Zealand market that are different. Maybe there's different competitors there. Maybe there's different taste. Maybe there's different players in the market. Maybe consumer behaviors are different. So that's the type of questions that you have to ask. And if you ask yourself questions of each assumption, is this true? Is it likely to remain true under all circumstances? What happens if it's not true? Does the plan still work? Then look at the answers to those questions and see if there aren't ways that you can kind of ratchet down loose parts of your strategy and make them stronger, make them more resilient. That's kind of at the simplest level what red teaming is about. If you do that, even if you don't even read the book, if you just do that, I guarantee you that you'll make your plans better and your decisions more sound. And then you can just go from there and do even more as you learn more about red teaming.
This is Best Practice with me, Richard Ady, and my guest today is Bryce Hoffman. He's the author of Red Teaming, Transform Your Business by Thinking Like the Enemy. And we've kind of been talking about its roots and how you do it. You come up with a set of seven rules of the red team. And the first one really struck a chord with me. Don't be a jerk.
Yeah, that's really red teaming rule number one, and I have to give credit to Colonel Rotkoff for having come up with that. It's probably the most important rule too, Richard, because I can't say this strongly enough. There's a difference between being skeptical and being cynical, and there's a difference between being critical to show how smart you are and being critical to help an organization be smarter. And red teamers have to be skeptical, but they can never be cynical. And they have to be critical, but they always need that criticism to be constructive and not destructive. And so the most important rule, like I say, is just don't be a jerk, because it's very easy to look at a plan or strategy and see the flaws in it and to want to show everyone else how brilliant you are by saying, oh, look at what these idiots did. You know, here's the problem right here. If you do that, though, all you succeed in doing is making yourself into a smartass. Nobody really wants to listen to a smartass.
Yeah, exactly. And if you annoy people, then you kind of run into that first order problem of human nature, which is that you can forgive someone for being wrong, but you can't forgive them for being right. And so if they're right and they've been a jerk about it, being right will not help at all. The other thing you say, the next rule, and I think this is absolutely true, is that red teams must have top cover. They have to have an official sanction right from the very top of the organization, don't they?
Absolutely. You know, one of the first rules they taught us when I went through the Army's red team training program at Fort Leavenworth is you can't red team in the Führer bunker. You know, you can't red team in an organization where the leader of the organization believes that they know everything and aren't interested in hearing anyone else's point of view and don't believe there's a better way to do anything than they're already doing it. There's no point in red teaming in that environment. If that's the type of company you're in, then my best advice is to simply brace for impact, because your competitors will red team you. But when you do have top cover, when you do have buy-in from senior leadership, then red teaming becomes a very powerful thing. Because going back to the question that you posed about what do you do if you're a leader who sees the value in this, you know, if you're a leader who sees the value in red teaming, that means you have a desire to do better. That means that you know the truth that all great leaders know, which is that there's always a way to do better, that there's always room for improvement, and that you're willing to look for it and to find those things before your competitors find them. One of the examples that I give in the book is a couple of years ago when Google spun itself off and created a new company called Alphabet. Larry Page, the co-founder of Google, sent a memo out to employees explaining why they were doing this. And one of the things that he said in that memo that's so relevant to red teaming, Richard, is that we've reached a point in business where incremental change is not enough, where continuous improvement is not enough to even stay in business, let alone stay at the top of an industry. That if you want to really succeed in business today, you have to constantly make great leaps forward. Because if you don't, a new competitor will make a great leap forward over you. That's a lesson that cab drivers all over the world have learned the hard way, right? Mm. And so when you do have top cover, when you have a leadership that sees that, then red teaming can really help the company make, you know, kind of be the jetpack that allows them to jump ahead like that. But without it, it's just kind of professional navel gazing.
This other one, don't red team things to death. How do you know when to stop?
Well, you know, that's the tough one because, you know, as I say in the book, red teaming is as much an art as it is a science. And there is such a thing as red teaming things to death. The best red teamers are those who know when to red team just enough and no more. And you learn that over time. But there's, you know, there's some things that I talk about in the book that can help you kind of find that point. And one of them is that fortunately, in most cases, there will be some sort of external deadline. You know, a decision will have to be made. Are we going to buy this company or not? Are we going to launch this new product or not? What I advise people, though, is in the absence of an external decision forcing factor like that, make one yourself. Set a deadline for the red team. Say, we're going to look at this for 2 days or 2 weeks or 2 hours, whatever you have time for. And then when you hit that point, make a decision, because red teaming is not supposed to get in the way of making a decision. It's supposed to help make decisions better. So it can never be allowed to get in the way of making a decision when a decision needs to be made.
How do you gauge the success of the red team, especially if this is new to you? You know, perhaps you've brought in a consultant, perhaps you're large and well-resourced and imaginative enough to set up a team inside your organization. I suppose I'm wondering how you know, when you know, that it's working.
That is probably the toughest question that confronts every red teamer. As one of the U.S. Army colonels who created the red teaming program for the United States puts it, what is the sound of no dogs barking? Because when you do your job right as a red teamer, bad things don't happen, right? So if they don't happen, how do you know that you've been successful? Because they didn't happen.
Yeah, and there's somebody's always going to say, well, hey, that didn't happen.
Yeah. So I've thought a lot about this question, Richard, and I was talking to the CEO of a very large global company a few weeks ago, and he posed this question to me, and I said, you know, I think it's kind of like the Higgs boson particle. You know, if you listen to scientists talk about what's going on in Switzerland with the Higgs boson particle, they'll tell you they actually can't see the Higgs boson particle. What they see is the ripples, the kind of the pathways of it moving through the ether, so to speak, when they slam atoms together. And that's how they know it's there. And so what I say is that red teaming is very much like that. If red teaming is working in your organization, you'll know it because over time you'll make better decisions. You'll make less mistakes. You'll have less regrets. And that's how you'll know it's working, is not by what it's doing so much as what is what you see not happening, the bad things that are not happening.
Are there things it can't do that we shouldn't expect it to do, that it would be inappropriate to try to get it to do?
Absolutely. And this is, you know, probably the best one, Richard, is the one that I have to remind executives that I work with all the time about, is red teaming is not looking into a crystal ball. Red teaming cannot predict the future. It can show you the different ways that the future could unfold, and it can show you the different ways that those different possible futures could impact your strategy or plan, and it can help you account for those different possibilities in your planning. But it can't predict the future. And I think that's important to remember, because at the end of the day, all any of us can do is do the best job we can to make our strategies and make our plans as bulletproof and as buttoned down as they can be, and then execute them and know that we did our best. And if something happens that is completely off the radar, then you've just got to hope that you've baked in enough resilience through red teaming to weather that. That's really, I think, the limit of any sort of, you know, kind of strategic tool.
Bryce, it's a really thought-provoking and challenging set of ideas. Thank you very much for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure, Richard.
That's Bryce Hoffman. I spoke to him via Skype. Bryce is the author of Red Teaming, How to Transform Your Business by Thinking Like the Enemy, published in Australia by Hachette. You'll find details on the Best Practice homepage at abc.net.au/rn. And that's the show for this week. Best Practice is produced by Ian Coombe, our sound engineer Simon Branthwaite. I'm Richard Ady. Thanks for listening.